Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And my name is Mike Shackelford.
Tonight our guest is Anne Fried-Lefton, a tax accountant specializing in gambling issues, in addition to being a good friend and a rabid New York Giants fan. We'll be talking to Annie shortly. I received an email this past week about the Windfall Lottery in Massachusetts. This was, past tense, a lottery where players could play with an advantage on certain, usually readily identifiable occasions. I sent a note to Michael suggesting we talk about it, and he told me he's already discussed this lottery, among others, on the WizardOfOdds.com website on an FAQ, Frequently Asked Questions page, devoted to lotteries. I had previously ignored that particular page on his website simply because lotteries in general are very bad bets for the player. So, Michael, what made this Windfall Lottery particularly interesting to gamblers seeking an edge?
This is one of the few gambling games that did have an advantage, and not just that, but it wasn't all lumped up in a big jackpot. But, the player that wasn't, you didn't need to count on a huge jackpot to necessarily have an advantage is if you still bought thousands and thousands of tickets. Now, the reason this game had an advantage is that if the progressive jackpot got past $2 million, the state of Massachusetts said, this jackpot is getting too big, let's roll this money down, leaving $500,000 in the jackpot for the next lottery, and taking the other $1.5 million or whatever it was, and sprinkling it down to the lower prizes for the next drawing. It was a simple pick six numbers out of 46, and whenever there was a drawdown, it did create a player advantage, and some knowledgeable professional gamblers knew about this. They were good about keeping it quiet because I never knew about this until after the state of Massachusetts got rid of it. Then suddenly there was a fair bit of media attention about it last year, and that's when I wrote about it. And now interest in it seems to be kicking up a little bit again.
Well, the interesting part of this is players typically bent the rules on this lottery. They would hire store owners to keep their store open all night long so they could keep entering lottery tickets even though the store was closed for other reasons, and among other things. Getting your money down on this lottery was pretty tricky. If you could correctly predict when this roll-down effect would happen, you were going to do well. But if you got your money down before this roll-down thing happened, you got burned. You lost about 40% of your money. And if it happened without you, then it might be several months before it happened again. So you had to get pretty good at predicting when this would happen. The state would help you out. They would predict when it happened. And they were usually right, although some of the teams decided, we'll surprise everybody else and we'll bet like hell and we'll make it happen when nobody else is expecting it.
Yeah, indeed. Another thing that makes a story interesting is that the state started to restrict the number of tickets that each store could sell. And some stores did not abide by that rule, and with the limits in place, lots of times the store owner would buy all the tickets themselves or sell them all to a friend, and I think that engendered a lot of complaints to the Massachusetts Lottery of people that were locked out of the game because the stores had already sold their quota.
Yeah, in the first 10 minutes.
And, yeah, one thing that I think may have made it strategic is I think that it, once the jackpot got past $2.5 million, I think that it got kicked down for that particular lottery. So maybe if it was not sure if it was going to go over or not, then it would, might have been a gamble whether or not you're going to play it, hoping that it went over the $2.2 million mark, if I understand the rules correctly.
Another thing about lotteries, which is different than other kind of gambling, if I'm going to bet in video poker $500,000 of coin in, I'm betting the same money over and over and over again. I get a full house. Well, that's going to pay me back 40 or 45 coins, depending on what game I'm playing, and I just continue to bet it again. So I may be down $20,000 in cash and generate $500,000 in action. In a lottery, if you want to buy $500,000 worth of lottery tickets, you have to have $500,000. You can't recycle this within the same week. So this is a different form of gambling than what we're used to. Now, filling out lottery tickets and then checking them afterwards for whether or not you had a winner is an extremely tedious and boring thing to do, but important. Important to do it accurately. This would be a, if somebody enjoyed being a bookkeeper, this would be the type of thing that they might excel at. I would think Annie, as an accountant, would find this interesting for about 4 minutes. And then it's mindless. She gives me a sign and said, that's 3.8 minutes too long. Okay, so good. Anyway, I found that interesting.
Now, I wonder if the stores get bothered if someone just brings in a huge stack of tickets that they've never even checked and asks to run every single one of them through.
I'm sure there were all kinds of reasons for stores to get bothered, and and there are people who push the envelope regularly.
It is a little change of topic, but when I bet on the Super Bowl, I run through all my tickets just to play it safe, just to make sure that I scored them correctly. And sometimes the way a bet is described on the ticket is not the way it actually was.
Yes, sometimes it'll say it won't account for what happens on a tie. There are some times where you're betting the over three, but if it's exactly three, you get your money back. But if it's over three, you win, for example. But it's not real clear on the ticket whether or not which that is.
And you might have a bet like largest lead in the first half over under 7.5 points. But maybe when it prints out the ticket, it leaves off the in the second half because there's only so much room to describe the bet on the ticket.
That could be critical. All right, so good. Different subject. We got an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. There's this visitor coming to Las Vegas soon, and he's going to place about 500 hands of video poker. He knows both jacks are better, 9-6 jacks, and 10-6 double-double bonus. And he's going to play 1,000 hands, 500 hands, somewhere in that range. And he hates to lose, so he wants to know which of the games he should play, giving him the highest chance to take money home. Under that scenario, because he doesn't seem to be concerned about the amount of a win, it's just did he win or not. So under that scenario, jacks are better, even though it's 0.5% lower in EV, is by far the better bet. Double-double bonus has jackpots of $400 and $800 and $2,000 in addition to the Royal. And even the normal four of a kinds are $250. And getting these jackpots can put you way over the threshold. And jacks are better doesn't have those. It has four of a kind is 125. and the rare straight flush is 250. The big difference between the games is you're going to get about every 10 hands are going to get two pair. And if you played 500 hands, that's an extra $250 that you'd get in jacks or better that you wouldn't get in double-double bonus. So I would recommend this guy plays jacks or better, and I would also suggest that playing not to lose is a really poor reason to gamble. And if he really was that worried about not losing, he should stay at home or go bowling or something anyway. He shouldn't even be in a casino. So, Annie, you're writing feverishly over there. Do you have a comment on this particular, or is that something else? I think she's doing a Sudoku. Okay, good. Now, I think of Annie as more of a friend than a tax expert, but she's both. She's been a... she passed the examination 20 years ago. She has been doing taxes for small businesses and individuals in New Jersey 3 months a year for quite some time. Her website is called thetaxgal.com, and she's an enrolled agent. She has offices in several states. But primarily her tax business runs out of New Jersey for 3 months a year, which from my point of view is the good 3 months a year, because if by any chance her Giants are in the Super Bowl, then after the Super Bowl she'll go straight to New Jersey, and by the time she gets back to Vegas again it's been 3 or 4 months, and so she's fine. But immediately after Giants win a Super Bowl, she'd be insufferable, and so we don't have to put up with her on that. But Annie, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you.
Now, have there been any changes in the way gambling expenses are deductible?
Actually, there's been a significant change in that the IRS acquiesced a rule change. The Bulletin 2012-3, which is Mayo versus the Commissioner, now says that expenses incurred by professional gamblers are deductible under Section 162, not subject to 165D. That's a lot of numbers. But what that means is Section 162 allows a deduction for ordinary and necessary business expenses during the taxable year. Cab fares, pencils, notebooks, computer software. Whereas Section 165...
So my books are totally deductible for all the listeners.
All professional gamblers.
Oh, this is a professional gambler only.
Yes.
Okay.
And Section 165 provides that... deductions are only allowed until the extent of winnings. So for all this time, the official policy has been that you could not claim a loss on Schedule C as a professional gambler. And although there were a lot of cases where the IRS accepted losses, they never had a formal policy. And in 2012, they are now allowing it for professional gamblers to have losses.
So to dumb this down a little bit, what you're saying, if I understand it correctly, is previously the professional gambler declared his winnings, and then that big number got used for such things as what portion of your Social Security got taxed, and then you got to subtract your losses.
You're going too far. What I'm talking about is the actual Schedule C. So in the past, according to the technical rules of the IRS, if you had $100,000 in gambling winnings, you could only have up to $100,000 in losses. Now what they're saying is if your losses were $88,000 and your expenses were $15,000, you can then have a loss for the taxable year. And that's what's huge, that you can have a loss if you actually have a loss, because you can add your losses plus your expenses. In the past, you could not do that.
Okay.
All right. Now, in general, so you're talking about this is good for professional gamblers only. So in the thumbnail sketch reasons, what would be the advantages or disadvantages of being a professional gambler instead of a non-professional?
Well, if you can qualify, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later, being a professional gambler means you have one number, a net number. So all of your winnings less all of your losses go on the face of the 1040. And that helps you significantly if you have medical expenses. By reducing your AGI, the percentage that...
Adjusted gross income.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. That number is reduced so that the deduction for medical expenses that you lose is reduced. The deduction for miscellaneous expenses is reduced. Now, specifically for seniors who are receiving Social Security, if you file as a professional gambler, less of your Social Security can become taxable if you get to net out your winnings and your losses. And that can make a significant difference. For example, if you have $25,000 of gambling income.
That would be W-2Gs or just anything you report as gambling income?
Everything that you have as gambling income. Okay. If your W-2Gs are less than your actual gambling income, then you need to report the gross amount, which might be in excess of the W-2Gs. But if you take a typical person who is a senior who has $6,000 in interest and dividends and capital gains and has Social Security of $17,000, if you have a $25,000 net number for gambling and you're not a professional gambler and you subtract $25,000 on Schedule A, you're going to owe $793. If in fact you were a professional gambler, you would owe nothing because you would net out the expenses against the income right on the front of 1040, and it wouldn't make your Social Security fully taxable. And the numbers get much larger as the numbers go up. For example, if it's 50,000 and you did not make any money, so if you've received 50,000 in W-2Gs yet you didn't make any money, the tax would be $1,529 if you did not file as a professional gambler, even though you had zero gambling winnings. True winnings was zero. You're still going to be paying taxes of $1,529. And that's just the tip of the iceberg because you have many states that don't allow gambling losses. So if you're a professional gambler and your losses go against your winnings, you don't have to worry about the implications of the state.
Which states don't allow deducting gambling losses against winnings?
Okay, those states would be Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, and West Virginia. And then there are some other states, like Minnesota, Louisiana, and New York, which apply limitations on your itemized deductions. So, for example, in New York, if your AGI is in excess of $500,000 from gambling W-2s plus wages, interest, and everything put together, you get zero as an itemized deduction. So, therefore, whatever your losses were, you wouldn't have any benefit at all. And that state tax can go up to 8%.
Okay. Now, I imagine some people in the audience may have just heard your answer two questions ago and said, you know, I do a lot of gambling. I think I would make out better if I filed as a professional gambler. So for IRS purposes, who is a professional gambler?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's not as simple as we would like it to be. The IRS maintains that a professional gambler does it full-time. They do it for primary source of income, and the words that they use have been literal for all these years, that you must be full-time, that you're relying on gambling for your primary source of income, and they've rejected professional gambler status for people that maintain other businesses. And none of those cases have ever made it to tax court. So although there are people who have multiple businesses and are successful in an audit as a professional gambler, you can't rely on any of that because it hasn't been either acquiesced to by the IRS or appear as a ruling in tax court.
Okay. Like, I have other businesses other than being a gambler. And I'm a writer, for example, and a host of a radio show, although this income is rather negligible. But I have other sources of income. And over a course of 10 years, my gambling income is by far the majority. But there have been years where my writing income was higher than my gambling income. There's even one year I had a gambling loss. So, but I had $3.5 million of W-2Gs that year. Would I still have been a professional gambler even though I was a losing gambler that year and had other businesses?
In my opinion, the thing that decides whether or not you're a professional gambler is whether you're devoted to it more than you're devoted to other things, that you take it seriously and that you use all available resources, you buy training software, you read books, you keep full books and records like a business would, and essentially treat it like any ordinary business would, that you know you're trying to make a profit. If you're doing it for fun, if you're doing it,
all those things, I would qualify. But I hate audits.
Doesn't everybody? Even me.
So one topic I often hear people talking about in Las Vegas elevators is how to keep track of their gambling activity to deduct losses against their W-2G wins. So what does the IRS like to see?
Well, the IRS wants you to keep a diary. And the diary could be written in book format. The diary can be maintained electronically. Now that most people have iPhones and iPads, there's a number of different types of tracking software that will do everything that's required. But specifically, the IRS requests the date and type of your specific wager or wagering activity, the name and address or location of the gaming establishment, the amount that you won or lost. And they have different rules for different types of gambling. For keno, they want the copies of the tickets that you've purchased. For video poker, they want a record of the machine number and all the results, coin in, coin out, profit and loss, by date and time the machine was played. Same for slot machines. Bingo, they want to know how many games that you played, and so forth and so on. They have different rules for the different types of wagers.
How about table game players?
Table games, they want to know the number of the table that you're playing and what casino credit data that they have. So if you got credit at the pit or the cashier's cage, they use that to help you track.
I have been forgetting to record the table numbers when I play. So don't tell.
Okay. I don't think that table game players are audited as much as video poker players. But it all depends. The IRS does a lot of what's called lifestyle audits. For example, if you're showing that you make $30,000 a year as an auto mechanic and you're driving a new Mercedes every year and you live in $1 million home, they're going to wonder where the money came from. And if you look at some of the famous cases in history, the way they got some of the famous crime figures was to go after them for failure to pay income taxes.
This is getting outside of gambling, but what other government agencies does the IRS share information with so they know how wealthy people are?
Well, it's not what the IRS shares it with, it's who reports to the IRS. In the past several years, the IRS is trying, with the help of Congress, of course, to reduce the amount of money that's not reported. So now, for the first time last year, there's a new form called the 1099-K, which all eBay users over certain criteria, all PayPal users over certain criteria got for the first time. So many people were filing Schedule Cs or reporting income for money that they sold items for. You know, they've been cleaning out their house, they've been buying and selling things on eBay and never reported it since eBay has been in existence. So that's one way the IRS is getting information now. They're also getting information from all the brokerage firms. Last year was the first year that the basis, which is the cost that you paid for the stock, usually, was being reported directly to the IRS. And the IRS does 100% matching. They do that on W-2Gs that are reported. They do that on the 1099-K, the 1099-B, 1099-D. Whatever your income is, if it's reported to them electronically, they match it against your tax return. And they'll send you a letter. They're not going to audit you. They're going to send you a CP-2000, which is their form number for saying, oops, you forgot something on your tax return. You better put it down. This is what we think you owe because this is what you left off. And when you get that letter, you need to address it. You can't just forget about it. You either say they're correct and write the check, or you send the backup why they're wrong. For example, your name is the same as someone else's and the income wasn't really yours. Or you send them an amended return while you're challenging the way they calculated the tax.
So they compare what you declare in W-2Gs to what they know you got?
Yes.
And no, what not if you what they know they got, what the casinos reported you got, which is not the same thing.
Correct. It's what the casinos tell them that you have. And often, I don't know if it's often or sometimes, but the casinos sometimes send W-2Gs for the wrong year. They in the beginning in January, they're using the wrong form. They send that with the wrong year. So you might have too much in one year and not enough in another. They make different mistakes coding Social Security numbers. So they're sending it to the wrong person who has a similar Social Security number to you. So you might wind up having a list of W-2Gs that weren't yours, and the CP-2000 would identify them, and you can easily see if they were yours or not if you keep accurate records.
Now, whenever I have gone W-2G by W-2G with a casino, their records are always different than mine. I trust my records more than I trust the casino's records.
Let me ask you a question first.
Yes.
Are you saying the W-2Gs, the actual tax slip that you received is different, or their summary for the year of your wins and losses?
Their summary of the year, including how much they think I got in W-2Gs and how much I physically have copies of paper of W-2Gs, are not the same. It has been sometimes one is when the casino is reporting less, the IRS will accept me reporting more. They have an infinite capacity to accept me declaring more W-2Gs. But when it goes the other way and the casino is reporting double, which it did in one case because of the record system, you know, this triggers an audit or this triggers the CP-2000 or something. So, is there a way you can find out what has been reported to the IRS in terms of your particular case in W-2Gs or 1099s or something else?
Absolutely. Each year, usually by September, they would be able to provide you with a transcript. And the transcript would show a list of all the W-2Gs that have been reported to the casino. And that can be received by filling out a form 4506, and the other way to get it is to go to the IRS office in person and they will print it out for you. And that transcript's very helpful to make a comparison. If you use a tax preparer who's registered with the IRS under their e-file services, then you can go to your preparer, and the preparer can, with a copy of a power of attorney from you, get a list of the transcript for you.
So, but it's in September, and that's your initial form is due April 15th, and you need a couple extensions to still be active by September.
Only one extension. Everyone who requests it gets an automatic extension to file of 6 months from April till October. Sometimes the transcripts are available earlier, But a lot of times the casinos get extensions on when they have to send it in by, or the banks, or in most cases the extensions are going to the stockbrokers. Not the brokers, but the big companies to report your dividends. So the IRS doesn't like to give out transcripts, and they say they're not available if you want one in April or May. But sometimes June, July, and August, they are available.
Okay. One question that I have heard debated many times is about CTRs, or cash transaction reports. And this is especially applicable to sports bettors that make very large bets. And many of them will go to great lengths to never have $10,000 in cash ever cross the counter, because they say that it sets off a red flag to get audited. True or false?
False. Although it could set off an audit, if the IRS audited everyone who dealt with $10,000 in cash, they would need a significant larger amount of staff to handle all of it. They're just looking to keep track of what's going on, and they're really using that for money laundering. They don't want people coming in and making an even money bet and taking the illegally gained money and putting it down, and then getting, you know, the receipt from the casino, and therefore they now have what's known as clean money. But they also do reports if you have $3,000 or more in a ticket cashed at the cage. And although that doesn't go directly to the IRS, the casino is required to maintain that. And if you're audited, you can request a copy of that to help in your audit, showing what you actually cashed in and out.
But cashing at these casinos, you can actually put in, many of them, $3,000 into the machine. You win one hand and you're over the limit. So I mean, it's just whether or not you're over $3,000 when you cash out, it has no bearing as to whether or not you won or not.
Absolutely correct. And most people don't keep track of what they cash out without keeping track of what they put in. You know, the two go hand in hand together in calculating wins and losses.
All right. If I lost last year, I didn't, but let's say I had a losing gambling year in 2010, the calendar 2010. And in 2011, I had a winning session. Is there anything I can do to income average or anything like that under any scenarios?
Income averaging was available in the 70s and hasn't been since early 80, I believe in 1981. A loss for 1 year cannot be combined with a win for the prior year or the future year.
Can a win from a year and a win cannot be...
You can't carry your win back or forward to help offset loss from prior year. Most individuals, not all, but most individuals are on a calendar year.
Uh-huh.
And when you're on a calendar year, that's the two deciding factors for your win or loss. And you can't combine multiple years.
So there can be, if you're having a winning year, it can make sense to leave money in, not cash out your cash back or not cash out your free play or something. And if you're losing, you want to cash out everything before the end of the year, and which is one, if it still belongs to the casino in terms of cash back you haven't redeemed yet, then that would be one way to carry money across annual boundaries.
Yeah, that's good tax planning. You know, a lot of people accelerate expenses and push forward income. They ask their company not to consider them for a bonus. And that's some, you know, at the end of the year, that's one of the strategies that you use in all areas, not just gambling. There's one thing that I wanted to talk about that I've gotten a lot of questions about.
Uh-huh.
And that's the cost of Medicare. Starting last year, if you were an individual and your modified adjusted gross income was $85,000 or less, or a married couple with a modified adjusted income of $170,000 or less, your standard premium was $115.40. But as the income goes up, the premium was up. So the difference between the lowest premium of $115 and the top premium of $369 is an additional $254 a month that gambling income or W2G income can cost the senior or the handicapped person, excuse me, the disabled person that's receiving both Social Security or disability and paying for Medicare. So that's something that people have been concerned about. That's something that's very new. And when you did your taxes this year, you saw that for the first time, it came with a bill from Social Security saying, now that we've recorded your income, we're raising your premium and we're reducing the amount of benefits that you received. So that's another reason why, if you can qualify as a professional gambler, that you would want to.
Do we have time for another question?
We do.
Speaking of strategies to lower your taxes, in the last 2 years, Mitt Romney made $42.7 million and paid $6.2 million in federal income taxes for a tax rate of 14.5%. So how does he do it, and can the professional gambler do the same thing?
Okay. There's something called a marginal tax rate, which means what your next dollar of income is going to produce. And that goes from zero all the way up to 35%. However, there are a lot of different deductions that people are entitled to. You can own a home. You can pay interest on that home. You can have real estate taxes. You can buy a lot of cars where you pay, in the state of Nevada, a use tax on. You could have a lot of medical expenses. You can have a lot of passive income. It's very complicated situations. You can have capital losses to offset some of your income. So there's many different ways that you can reduce your marginal rate and make your actual rate much lower. Way too complicated for any hour. I'm sure that he has many tax professionals working on his particular situation.
But doesn't he basically classify most of his income as capital gains, which is taxed at a lower rate?
Possibly.
Possibly. I haven't looked at his personal tax return. But up until the expiring at the end of this year, so December 31st, 2012, the capital gains rate on all items held over a year has been 15% for the average earner and 0% for low-income earners. So it's possible, although not likely in Mitt's case, that there was reduced gains reported for that reason. They also matched the dividends for the last 2 years at 15% instead of ordinary income, which might be as high as 35%.
Well, is it possible to say set up a company and call it, say, an investment company, but your investments are actually made in the casinos with the advantage gambling, and then classify the income from that company as capital gains?
And make $47 million along the way.
Well, it'd be very hard for me to understand how income earned in a casino could become a capital gain, because I don't see any assets that you're buying or selling. And that's what a capital gain is.
Okay.
If people had a choice of where to live, they were, say, essentially retired and was going to be a gambler, would be good states to live in, or what would be bad states to live in, strictly financially, not concerned with quality of life, perhaps, or something like that?
Well, any state that doesn't have a state income tax would be financially better to live in. And those states are Alaska, Florida, Nevada, South Dakota, Texas, Washington, or Wyoming. Additionally, New Hampshire and Tennessee tax only dividends and interest income. They don't tax gambling incomes. The states that are bad are the ones that I mentioned before, the ones that don't allow you as an ordinary gambler to deduct your losses: Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, and West Virginia. and the three states that apply limitations, Minnesota, Louisiana, and New York.
Well, I'm actually glad that we put this, we archived this, because some of these lists, which are would be good to go back to, people can't get it the first time, and so they can go back to the 41-minute mark of the hour and do all that. That was good.
And if anyone's ever listening to a podcast of the show long into the future, this today is August 9th, 2012.
Uh-huh. Very good.
So, Bob, I have a quick question for you.
You have a question for me?
Yep.
Uh-huh. Sorry, we're out of time, folks. Go ahead.
What is the difference between praying in a church and praying in a casino?
Oh, my God.
Oh, I know the answer.
This is a question that I would ask every week in video poker class. And the answer was always, when you pray in a casino, you really, really mean it. Now, Annie used to run the projector in my class. She was one of my helpers, and for which I'm very grateful. And so whenever I would ask this question, she would slap herself in the head and just groan in physical pain that whenever I would ask this question, because she'd heard it 45 times before, or 80. However, the weeks I would not ask that question, she'd come up afterward and says, "Oh, Bob, by the way, you forgot to ask about praying in church." So I could not win. Now, is that the way you recall it, Annie?
Well, I think after 50 times, I groaned very loudly each time. But I couldn't resist being on the air with you and not asking you that question after having listened you ask it of the classes at least 100 times.
At least. All right, good. Actually, as questions she could have asked goes, I got off pretty easy. All right. So, Michael, what did we learn tonight?
I learned a lot of stuff today. Where to begin? I learned, you know, records that you're supposed to keep as a professional gambler. I didn't know about recording the table number if you're a table game player. And
that probably isn't important. You probably, the people who've been audited in video poker who do not record their machine number have never, I've talked to several of them, and nobody's ever mentioned, "Boy, they sure nailed me because I didn't record machine numbers."
Yeah, and I've heard that when an audit does happen, they're not terribly legalistic about these rules, but they do want to see something.
That's absolutely correct. You know, the more information you have, the more they're going to evaluate your records favorably. If you're throwing numbers together without the date, without the casino, without the game that you played, with very little information, they're not going to listen and accept the records as easily as they would if you had all the details. You know, I didn't mention it, but there's a publication, 4706, and it's part of the Lifestyle series, and it says, the title on it is "You Won, What Now?" And it's "Be Informed About Your Federal Income Tax Responsibilities," and it summarizes many of the things that we talked about tonight, and you can get that online.
Good. All right. And this is, if you want to more about Annie, is thetaxgal.com, and you can send her an email there should you wish to. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games returning more than 99%. That is more than anybody else. Every day in August at 9:20 p.m., 10 names are drawn in the $1 million August Cash Blast. First prize is $10,000. Or $25,000 if you're there within 10 minutes. The other 9 winners get $1,000 each. Maximum number of tickets are earned by playing $1,000 coin in. This is a day-by-day drawing, and all entries evaporate right after the drawing. So if you're in town for a few days, you are not at a disadvantage compared to anybody else. They have a senior slot tournament on Thursdays. First entry is free. You can earn 2 more with a modest amount of play. The South Point was one of the first 2 casinos approved to have intrastate online poker, meaning only Nevada residents are eligible to play. It'll be a few months before all the I's are dotted and T's crossed, but it's in the works, and South Point was was one of the first two. At the Palms, the weekly drawings take place Friday and Saturday evenings. 10 players earn cash. The first 5 names drawn win an average of $1,100 apiece. Places 6 through 10 win cash averaging $275 apiece. The August PEW, standing for Play, Earn, and Win, is now back to 3 days a week instead of July's 5 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Through next Wednesday, the 15th, you earn kitchen stuff for play. Starting Friday, the 17th, you can earn up to $220 in free play each of the 3 days a week. We don't yet know what the rate is. It's likely to be better than double points and not as good as triple points. On Thursdays, seniors can swipe and win up to $500 in free play or receive a Kindle Fire. 3 days a week, you get approximately a 75% discount on the buffet if you earn the points that same day and redeem them. 75% off is something the highest tier players get every day anyway, but now all players can get that discount should they wish. All right, next week. Next week we have Buddy Frank. Buddy is the Vice President of Slot Operation at Pechanga Casino, which is just north of San Diego. It is the biggest casino, bigger than any casino in Las Vegas. Until recently, it was bigger than any casino west of the Mississippi, but now both the Choctaws and the Chickasaws have bigger casinos in Oklahoma. So Buddy's well-spoken about Pechanga in specific and table games or slot departments in general. So I've known Buddy for 10 years, and I'm looking forward to this. In 2 weeks, Munchkin will be revisiting us. He's a former co-host, good buddy, one of our favorite guests. And in 3 weeks, Steve Fezzik will be here, August 30th. He is arguably the most successful football handicapper out there, having won the Hilton Handicapping Contest twice in a row. Football season's almost upon us. You do not need to ask Annie who she's betting on. It will be the Giants. And we'll have lots of questions for Fezzik about handicapping with an edge. Arnold Snyder has been on the show 3 times. And he's recently started a new blog where he writes about fiction. It's called writeaholic.com. That's W-R-I-T-E hyphen aholic, A-H-O-L-I-C.com. Today I picked out one of his reviews at random. It was on The Grifters, which was a Jim Thompson book from 1963. I had seen the movie. I had not read the book before. After reading Arnold's review, I will check the book out from the library, and I'm actually looking forward to that. So all those things he writes about are fiction. He has received copies of Sex, Lies, and Video Poker and more Sex, Lies, and Video Poker, but so far has not seen fit to write about it on his blog. I'll have to give him a hard time about that. All right. Annie, we had, if Michael and I were in a gambling deal together, which we really haven't been, and, let's say we formed a football betting consortium and won $50,000, and I have to go cash the ticket at a casino, but I don't want all that stuff coming back on me. I want half of it to come back on him. How do we deal with that?
Well, you would bring to the casino Form 5754, which is a statement by person receiving gambling winnings. It has 2 parts. The first part is persons to whom winnings are paid, and part 2 is persons to whom winnings are taxable. So you would be the person to whom winnings are paid, and then half of the winnings would be going to Michael on part 2. Now, the form gets returned to the payer, meaning you, and you don't send it to the IRS.
What does the casino do with it?
the casino just acknowledges it and uses that to correctly issue the W-2G.
But I didn't think casinos gave W-2Gs to sports bettors most of the time.
Well, if you are cashing out a significant amount where the odds are within the IRS guidelines, they do issue W-2Gs for sports betting.
Well, I don't remember the rule off the top of my head, but I thought it had to be more than like a 300-to-1 shot.
Something like that.
And most good sports bettors don't make bets like that, other than maybe parlays, but let's ignore that. Let's say it's all roughly even money bets.
Well, then let's make it different. That you, you are my, you're my father, Michael, and we're playing in a casino, and I'm supervising you. You have no money. We're using all money, and I'm telling you how to play. And you hit a $4,000 W2G. Now, it's appropriate that I get the W2G, and not you. Now, if I have a form 5754, now sometimes the casino goes, okay, sure, we'll give it to you, Bob. Sometimes go, no, we're going to give it to the person who hit it. So if I have a 5754, then basically that requires them to give it to me. Is that correct?
That's correct. If they refuse to do it and you can't negotiate with them to accept it, then you would include it in your income and you would deduct it on your income in the same place, and note that a 5754 was issued and the ID of the person whose the income belongs to.
Now, would it also be acceptable to just do a 1099?
The 1099 miscellaneous, which is the form that you're thinking about, would be very confusing because people wouldn't know how to report it. Typically, they would file a separate Schedule C just for the 1099 miscellaneous. That's different than prizes, games, and awards that you could or couldn't lump with your gambling winnings depending on how you earned it. So that would be a little bit too confusing. But if you do issue someone a 1099 miscellaneous, you also have until February 30th to send that to the IRS as well.
February 30th might not get here next year.
February 28th.
Oh.
Well, in the situation where I usually have dealt with 1099s is I'm splitting wins in a tournament with somebody, and say one of us wins $200,000 and has to share it with the other person. Would it be appropriate then for the winner to give a $100,000 1099 to the loser?
Yes.
Okay. At least I'm doing something right.
Well, the right thing you did is to win that $200,000 jackpot. That's pretty clever.
Just remember to send it to the IRS as well as the other person.
All right. Now, we got about 30 seconds. If I win a car in a casino, is that the same as winning cash?
It depends.
That's a 30-second answer.
Well, if you got tickets in the drawing, assuming that you won a drawing, based on playing, and everyone had a different number of tickets that you actually had to do something to earn, then that's gambling. And it would be the same as cash. If you won the car without having to do anything, then it would be different.
Very good. Thank you. This is very educational. I hope to have Annie back. I may have to drag her kicking and screaming. Go hit lots of royals and flushes, everybody.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.